From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look at some of the differences between how Jewish and Christian scholars interpret the Old Testament. We talk with Mark Zvi Brettler about his new book, How to Read the Bible. He chairs the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University. And we talk with our critic at large, John Powers, about what he saw at the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. It's the 19th Sundance Festival that John's attended. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, Lord! Why have you chosen me? What would you have me do for you?
I shall give you my laws, and you shall take them unto the people.
Yes, Lord! Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.
That's Mel Brooks as Moses in a scene from his film History of the World, Part 1. We're about to get a more historically accurate picture of biblical times. My guest, Mark Zvi Brettler, is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. It's about Jewish interpretations of the Old Testament and how they compare with Christian interpretations, including their different understandings of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. The book explains how modern Jewish scholars try to interpret the Bible and understand the culture that produced it. Brettler is a professor of biblical literature and chair of the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University. Do Jewish people view the Old Testament differently from Christians?
Jews view the Old Testament so fundamentally differently from Christians that they wouldn't even use the term Old Testament. Using that term assumes that the Old Testament is really half of the Bible that is combined with the New Testament, and thus most Jews will prefer using the term Hebrew Bible or some similar terms, which suggests that the Bible for Jews comprises only a certain number of books. It does not include the Gospels, does not include the Epistles, and is a fundamentally different book.
Let's take a look at Genesis, the story of creation. Now, there's two different versions of the story in the Bible. Where are they both located?
Well, the first story obviously starts at the very beginning in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and it runs through the middle of verse 4 of the second chapter of the Bible. This is a story which has a very short introduction. It then talks about the 6 days of creation, and then it has a conclusion which talks about the Sabbath. The second story is actually the better known story, and that is the story that talks about the Garden of Eden, talks about the creation of woman from the rib, or other translations, from the side of man. And these are two fundamentally different stories with fundamentally different ideas, which I'm at least trying to argue, and here I'm very much part of the mainstream of biblical scholarship. These two stories should be read primarily as separate stories rather than combined together.
What are some of the most important differences between these two different versions of creation?
Well, I would actually say that the most significant difference is in terms of gender. There have been a lot of interpretations that have tried to connect gender studies to biblical texts. But in the first creation story, man and woman are both created at the same time. And according to most scholars, in terms of the way they understand the verse, they are both created in the image of God. And I'm referring to Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, which can be translated as God created person or humanity in his image. In the image of God did he create it. Male and female did he create them. In contrast to that, the second story has a very different order of creation. Adam is created first. God has a sense that Adam is lonely and creates all sorts of animals to bring before Adam. And it's really a comic scene if you allow yourself to laugh at the Bible, which I think in some cases is a good idea. You could imagine God is bringing the crocodile before Adam. Adam says, no, 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 this is not going to work for me. Then the hippopotamus, etc. No fitting mate for Adam is found. And only then, from the rib or the side of man, is Eve created. Now, there's a big debate about whether or not this represents subservience of woman to man or not. But what is clear from the second story is that after eating from the fruit, God speaks to the woman, and one of the things that he says is that he, namely Adam, shall rule over you. So no matter how we read the rest of the text, those particular words seems to suggest a subservient role of women to men, while in the first creation story, we have absolutely nothing like that.
Well, how do you reconcile this major difference?
Well, the answer is I refuse to ask your question. I don't think that these two stories should be reconciled. Much of what I'm trying to argue in How to Read the Bible is that the Bible is fundamentally an anthology rather than a unitary work or a unified work. And as such, we need to hear the different voices that are in the text. And thus, nothing upsets me more when I hear people say, the Bible says, and then they finish that sentence, and what they're really doing is they're picking one particular section of the Bible and ignoring what other sections say.
A good example would be if you're using the second Genesis story to explain that men are of greater stature than women, that women were created to be man's helpmate.
You're right, that would be a great example. Or since you asked me about both creation stories, perhaps a more theological example would be if somebody looked at Genesis chapter 1 and tried to imagine what God looks like with a broader depiction of God in that particular chapter. God is clearly highly majestic in that chapter. God says something and it comes true. Nature responds to God. However, in the second creation story, you do not have the same structure of majesty. There you have, and one could always wonder how literally this should be taken, God saying to Adam, "Where are you?" There you have a whole story which is based on a notion of God saying to Adam, "You can do everything but this." And especially those of us who are parents have a good sense that if you do that, you clearly know that your child is going to violate the one thing that he or she was told is not permissible. And thus, it's a very different image of God that you have in the second chapter. And which one is right? I don't know. They both appear, at least in my Bible, in the same size font, and it becomes very hard to decide how to balance which one is more correct or more accurate. And thus, I almost never want to say, the Bible says.
Yeah, well, you read the Bible more as story or myth than as history or science. So when you read the Bible as story or myth, what does it mean to you? What is the value of that?
Well, I'm glad you used the word myth first. Myth is a very problematic word, and I really wish that I could find a better term to use. But when I read the Bible as myth, I don't read it as a myth in the sense that many Americans think of a myth as a silly story or something that should not be believed in, but rather as a story that is attempting to charter fundamental values of a society. And I try to understand what these values are. Thus, the first creation story is trying to charter a world which is incredibly well organized, in which everything is in its place. I imagine the first creation story in terms of cubbies, and everything can be assigned into the proper cubby and is in perfect order. While the second creation story is imagining a world, which I must admit is much closer to the world that I know, a world which is somewhat messy, a world in which things do not go always as planned. For example, the notion that God could try creating animals as helpmates for people, but that doesn't work out. So God tries something else, and the second thing works out better. So I imagine these stories as ways of my ancestors, the ancient Israelites, really struggling with trying to understand the world and doing this in a way which was very common in such ancient societies, namely through stories rather than through science. And these stories, I believe, were not meant to be understood literally by and large.
So when you hear people making the case for intelligent design or creationism, based on the Bible, what do you say?
Well, I say to them that the first words of the Bible are not, "This is science." And I really ask them, why do they believe that this material is science? After all, a myth can be true without necessarily being literally true or scientific. I mean, let me give you an example of what I mean by that. I could say of a person, she is a rose, and somebody who is very literally minded could say to me, hold it, how can you say that that person is a rose? That person does not have beautiful petals. That person does not have a beautiful fragrance. That person does not have thorns, perhaps. And I would simply answer, hold it, you don't understand. I'm speaking metaphorically. And as such, a statement such as this is a rose does not have the same truth value as a statement this is a pen or this is a school or this is a radio show. And as such, if you understand something metaphorically literally, you're really misunderstanding it. Similarly, if you understand a myth as science, you are fundamentally misunderstanding it.
My guest is Mark Zvi Brettler. His new book is called How to Read the Bible. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Zvi Brettler, and he's the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. He is the chair of the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University, where he's also a professor of biblical studies. We talked a little bit about the Genesis story. Let's talk a little bit about the Ten Commandments. Are there controversies among biblical scholars about the meaning of any of the Ten Commandments and how they should be interpreted?
There are lots of controversies about the Ten Commandments. In fact, there's even a controversy about what they should be called. In English, we call them the Ten Commandments. The Hebrew does not say Ten Commandments. The Hebrew is Aseret HaDevarim, which means the Ten Sayings or the Ten Things. And if you look at various discussions of the Ten Commandments, you'll see that this difference in terminology really does make a difference. If you ask most non-Jews where the Ten Commandments begin, they will answer with a particular commandment, "You shall have no other gods before me." If you ask many Jews where the Ten Commandments begin, they will begin it with, "I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt," and so forth. And thus, whether you call them commandments or not, does make a very, very big difference in terms of what you include within them and where they begin. To say the obvious, the Ten Commandments do not have Roman numerals in the original Hebrew text. And as such, if you read them very carefully, you'll see that there are actually 13 or 14 statements which need to be divided into 10. Different religious traditions, different biblical scholars do this in a number of different ways. And to give you a sense of a controversy that exists within biblical scholarship, the last one, or according to other enumerations, the last two of these so-called commandments deal with coveting. And one question is, how can a commandment really talk about something that is internal to you? And scholars continue to debate whether in what I would call the Decalogue, which is a Greek term which really means the Ten Sayings, whether this is talking about desiring and desiring the heart is fundamentally wrong, or whether the particular unusual Hebrew verb that is used there actually refers to desiring which you act upon. So that's one fundamental difference that you have within biblical scholarship about what part of the Decalogue means, but there's a much bigger difference about what is included in the Decalogue and how it should be divided up into various sections.
Is the amount of emphasis that's placed on the Ten Commandments different in the history of Judaism than it is in the history of Christianity?
Yeah, I know less about the importance of the Decalogue in the history of Christianity, but I can answer that both in terms of the history of Judaism and even in terms of the history of Jewish printing. At some point, it became commonplace to have pictures of the Decalogue on the frontpiece of Jewish books. This was influenced by Christianity, which had it first. And in fact, when some of these Hebrew books were first published, people were wondering if the printers were really Jewish or if the printers were Christian. And this indicates that the Ten Commandments, or the Decalogue, was not really as prominent in Judaism as it was in Christianity. You have to remember that when you read the Bible as a whole, it is not the case that the Ten Commandments are the beginning of the Bible or at the end of the Bible or even right in the middle of the Bible. In other words, they're not really in a place of extreme prominence. So they're halfway through the book of Exodus. They're in the fifth chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. And nowhere do the Ten Commandments say either, I am the center of the Bible, or I am the main ethical lesson of the Bible. In my sense, especially listening to the contemporary American debate, is that this is something which has very much entered America from the Christian side rather than from Judaism or even from the place that the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue holds within the Hebrew Bible itself.
What surprises me to hear this is there is Jewish law, and I always assumed that the Ten Commandments were part of that and that that was a very important part of Jewish history, the laying down of and the following of Jewish law.
Yes, the Ten Commandments are part of Jewish law, but at least as the rabbis enumerated the laws in the Bible, there are a total of 613 laws, and so the Ten Commandments are some part of that, and it is not the case that according to all Jewish tradition, all of the laws of the Decalogue are important than all of the other 603 laws that you might have elsewhere in the Bible. And the second thing that needs to be said about the first part of the Bible, about the Torah, is that it is not all law, and the stories, and I would really argue the stories understood as myths, which help constitute a society and its values, are important on par with the laws themselves.
Does your interpretation of the Ten Commandments and their relative importance as a Jewish biblical scholar affect your position on the public display of Ten Commandments in courthouses or, you know, in public squares?
Yeah, I have a very strong feeling about that. And you might imagine that as a biblical scholar, I would love to see the Ten Commandments all over the place because, in a sense, it's publicizing the book that I teach and that is extremely meaningful to me. But on the other hand, I'm very bothered by the public display for a number of reasons. First of all, most public displays call them the Ten Commandments. These are not really Ten Commandments, especially from the Jewish perspective, where the Decalogue, what others call the Ten Commandments, begins with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. So just the title, Ten Commandments, already is removing it from the Jewish tradition. Secondly, in all of the statues that I've seen, or all the monuments for the Ten Commandments, they have very specific numerations. What is commandment number one? What is commandment number two? There are significant Jewish-Christian differences, and even differences within different branches of Christianity about how to enumerate the various commandments. And thus, any statue is going to take a particular choice and thus enfranchise one religious group rather than another religious group. There are other reasons I object. One of the commandments, according to many enumerations, it's the seventh commandment. In the Hebrew, it is Lo Tirtzach. Almost all of the monuments follow the King James translation, which says, Thou shalt not kill. That is simply not what the Hebrew means. The Hebrew means thou shalt not kill illicitly, thou shalt not murder, We can talk about whether this is for better or for worse, but the Hebrew Bible does include the notion of capital punishment. It does include the notion of just war. So thus, many of the translations bother me as well. And finally, I really wonder whether or not the Decalogue in its full form should have a place, especially in public buildings like courts. After all, one of the issues that is discussed in the Decalogue, if it is read in its entirety rather than its condensed version on many of these monuments, is the notion of intergenerational punishment, where children and even grandchildren, great-grandchildren are punished for sins which earlier generations had perpetrated. And I would really wonder what place this notion should have in sites like public courthouses. You put all of those reasons together, and I really believe that these monuments must be kept out of public spaces. They should be kept out of schools. They should be especially be kept out of public courthouses.
Mark Zvi Brettler is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. He chairs the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, independent filmmakers and big corporations get their names out in Park City, Utah. We talk with our critic at large, John Powers, about the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend, and we continue our interview with Bible scholar Mark Zvi Brettler. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Zvi Brettler, author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. It discusses how modern Jewish scholars interpret the Hebrew Bible. He chairs the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies at Brandeis University, where he teaches biblical literature. When you teach Bible classes now, are the interpretations that you teach considerably different from the ones that you were taught? And if they are, would you choose an example to show the interpretation that you were taught versus what you teach now?
The interpretations that I teach are certainly very different than the ones which I was taught as a child, going to a Jewish school. I guess the best way of representing this is to look at the stories that talk about the ancestors, what many people would call the patriarchs, but I think it's more important to be broader than that. The stories about Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, and his wives, where very often many people who read the Bible, and this is quite true within Jewish tradition, will understand these ancestors as models or as heroes that you are supposed to follow, and thus will whitewash certain things that are in the text which seem to suggest otherwise. While the interpretations that I offer in class and in my various books suggest that these are not really hero stories at all, that these people are not being presented or represented as role models that one needs to follow, but rather are stories that are working out values in various ways, stories that in some cases are entertainment, in some cases perhaps even high entertainment. And I would just point out that nowhere in the Bible does it say that these ancestors are ideal. And I think that the Bible is much more interested in showing human characters as characters with all of their foibles and is not really interested in showing them as heroic or as role models. That would be really one of the biggest differences between the way in which I was taught the Bible and the way in which I teach the Bible to others.
You write that in part of the interpretive literature of the Hebrew Bible, there's a tradition of describing God at the moment of revelation as a statue with faces on every side. What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance of that is most people claim that they understand revelation, that they understand the Bible, and that there is a simple meaning that the biblical text has. What that particular rabbinic passage, which you quoted, means to emphasize is that there is something fundamentally subjective about the understanding of each individual of the Bible, that each individual looks at the Bible and sees it from a different vantage point, sees a different face in the Bible, sees a different understanding of the divine by reading the Bible. And what that particular rabbinic text emphasizes is that each of those interpretations is legitimate, because actually that particular rabbinic tradition is an interpretation of the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments of, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. There you is in the singular rather than in the plural. Hebrew makes that distinction. And the point that the text is trying to make is that the subjectiveness of interpretation of each individual looking at the divine and looking at the biblical text is something legitimate, is something to be applauded, rather than something to anguish about as we search for the single correct voice in the Bible.
Which means that you're never searching for the single correct voice in the Bible.
I never am. I correct myself very quickly whenever I begin a sentence that says, the Bible says.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Mark Tzvi Brettler is the author of the new book, How to Read the Bible. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, talks with us about what he saw on and off screen at the Sundance Film Festival. This is Fresh Air. The Sundance Film Festival is the most important showplace for independent films. The 25th festival wrapped up over the weekend in Park City, Utah. This was the 19th time that our critic at large, John Powers, attended. We asked him to tell us what he saw on and off screen. So, John, what were your overall impressions of Sundance this year?
Well, I think, Terry, that this was the most schizophrenic I've ever known Sundance to be. On the one hand, you have this kind of tiny film festival, you know, filled with films by first and second time filmmakers. And it's resolutely unglamorous in a lot of ways. I mean, you really haven't lived until you've gone to one of the theaters and gone to one of the porta-johns outdoors when it's 18 degrees. So there's that festival with young filmmakers. But what's built up around it over the last 20 years is this kind of festive atmosphere. And in a way, you might compare it to the Super Bowl, where you actually have the game, and then you have all the stuff that surrounds it. And Sundance is that way. So you have this small festival devoted to lack of commercialism and independent thinking. You have that. What surrounds it is this corporate fiesta. So the city of Park City is taken over by companies like Heineken and Chrysler and BlackBerry, who buy up the storefronts for the time during the festival and throw big parties and musical events and giveaways. And what that means is the city's then flooded with people who have no interest in the actual film festival, but who come in order to catch a glimpse of someone like Paris Hilton, who, of course, was there. I mean, like God, Paris Hilton seems to be everywhere. So Paris Hilton's there, Al Gore is there, Jennifer Aniston's there, and they're all pouring in for the media event of the festival, which is super commercial, super celebrity-driven, super unindependent. And you have those two things happening at once. They're inhabiting the same space. And this produces a very zoo-like atmosphere where you will be trying to get from one place to the next in order to see a first-time film that may never have any commercial future. And in fact, there's a huge traffic jam because there are people trying to get uptown in order to go to a party or see a glimpse of Jennifer Aniston.
So in this kind of like dual environment, did you spend time hiding in your hotel room or going to the movies?
Yes. Well, it used to be that when I was covering Sundance, I would actually do both. It's now almost impossible to do both. You either wind up covering parties, which is, I think, what a lot of the media does, because when you watch television, that's what they seem to be covering, or you go to the movies. I go to the movies. And it's an interesting and frustrating experience, because the thing that people need to know about Sundance is that it's not every film that's available that shows at Sundance. They're actually trying to find new talent, and they're trying to find talent that usually doesn't have a very big budget behind it. Some years, there are still big movie stars. This was a year, it's the 25th anniversary of Sundance, and they were saying they went back to their roots. And what that means is that probably given a choice between a 50-50 call between a film with actors you've never heard of and actors you have heard of, they chose the smaller film. Because part of the strangeness of Sundance is that every year they get smacked for either being too commercial or not commercial enough. You know, if there are too many stars, people say Sundance is sold out. If there aren't enough stars, all the reports are what an incredibly dull festival it was.
John, tell us a little bit about the films at Sundance this year. Do you want to choose one or two that epitomize what's really special about Sundance and the kind of visibility it gives films that might otherwise never have been seen?
Yes, you know, there were a couple of films which were very much representative of what Sundance can do at its best. One was a very small film called Old Joy by Kelly Reichert, which I thought was the best film I saw in the entire festival. And it's a very simple story of two guys trying to rekindle an old friendship, you know, now that they've grown up a bit, trying to capture their youthful joys. And it's a very modest film in all of its externals. But it's Chekhovian because it is the story of these two guys who go off to a hot springs. And over the course of the movie, nothing seemingly happens. But by the end of the film, you're filled with melancholy and you understand completely the two people. It's very much like Chekhov. It's a wonderful film. At the opposite end, you said emotionally, you might have something like Wrist Cutters, a love story, which is based on an Israeli novella and is set in a world where everyone in it has already committed suicide. It's a kind of weird limbo. It's a black comedy, maybe in the Harold and Maude vein, where the hero kills himself and winds up in another reality where every single person there has killed himself. And then they're trying to work out the meaning of life in this limbo that's kind of presided over by a godlike figure played by Tom Waits.
Okay. There's a movie called Little Miss Sunshine that all the press coverage has emphasized. all the press coverage of Sundance. And this was a movie that sounds like it's actually pretty commercial and very entertaining that ended up not having a distributor until Sundance. What did you think of the film?
Yes. Little Miss Sunshine's a very good film. It was one of those films that is shown on the opening weekend with the idea that distributors will pick it up. And so it was the hottest ticket of the entire festival. And, you know, people actually were bidding, I'm told, hundreds of dollars to get a ticket to the screening. The film itself is very much a commercial film of the kind that Hollywood would make. It has Greg Kinnear and Toni Collette and Steve Carell, and it's about a dysfunctional family. The thing that makes it different is that it's probably the funniest film I've ever seen at Sundance, or at least the funniest film I've seen since the movie Citizen Ruth, that was the first film by Alexander Payne. In addition to that, it's the first Sundance comedy I've seen in at least 10 years, maybe ever, that you thought could actually travel outside the rarefied confines of Sundance. You know, there's a general principle with Sundance films is that once they leave Park City, Utah, where the festival is, they tend to seem smaller. This was a film when you were watching it, you thought, oh, actually, audiences everywhere will like this movie. It's really funny. It has a whole range of jokes, from really good slapstick gags to jokes about Proust and Nietzsche, which isn't something you get in a normal Hollywood movie. It's a very, very good and funny film.
Several of the major studios now have independent film divisions within them. So why is that happening, and how is it affecting the style of independent films and even what we describe as an independent film?
Yes. Well, in the old days, an independent film was something that seemed to have two qualities. It had financial backing that came from not from a studio, but from independent sources, and had independent vision. What's happened over the years is that as Hollywood has kind of gotten caught in the blockbuster complex, that they've looked for other sources of filmmaking ideas. And one of those sources is the aesthetic ideas that you found initially at Sundance in movies like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It turned out that such films could become profitable. And the industry, always looking to renew itself and buy up the latest thing, has now established a way in which every studio does have an independent division. And what they're doing is taking the kinds of themes and ideas that used to belong purely to independent film and integrating them into their own films. The examples of this year would be something like Brokeback Mountain. You know, it cost $14 million. It has an edgy subject, you know, put simply, you know, gay cowboys, and is done in a very simple style. You know, 15 years ago, this is the kind of film you might have seen at Sundance. I mean, it's better than that, perhaps, but it's the kind of film you might have seen then. But it's now a film from Focus Features, which is itself a branch of Universal. And Universal okayed the money and essentially paid for the film. And you find the same thing happening where every big studio has its branch, which brings out something. It will bring out its Capote. It will bring out its Good Night and Good Luck, which is a Warner Brothers film. And so what you've seen is that the studios have managed to acquire what used to be unique to independent film and make it part of its own.
One of the changes we've seen in the past few years in the film world is the popularity of documentaries at movie theaters. You know, they used to be played on television a lot, but it's only now that you're really seeing a lot of popular documentaries in movie theaters. And I think Sundance has played a role in popularizing the documentary and getting documentaries out there. So what was the documentary scene like at Sundance this year?
Well, I mean, Sundance has been crucially important for the development of documentaries, partly because they're so popular with the audiences in Park City. And I think people began realizing that if they're that popular with audiences there, they could be popular elsewhere. So every year, the documentary competition has grown more and more important. This year, I didn't see a lot of the documentaries. I saw some. And I just mentioned parenthetically, there are 120 films that play there, so that you're constantly picking and choosing, trying to find the correct ones to go to. This year, I went to see three documentaries about Iraq, very, very different documentaries that weren't particularly strident. One of them was clearly an anti-war film, but the two best films, one called Iraq in Fragments, which won three awards at the festival, you know, showed us things about what's going on in Iraq that I'd never seen before. You know, I've worked as a media columnist. I watch more television news than almost anybody I know. Yet what was interesting about these documentaries was that it showed you things that you never, ever saw on American TV screens. You know, the film Iraq in Fragments took you inside the life of a little boy in Baghdad, who's a Sunni, whose family members and people who push him around believe that things were better under Saddam. It also took you inside a Shiite militia. And among the things you got to see, which I'd never seen before, were the Shiite militias going in and beating up people that they thought were guilty of selling alcohol. And then finally taking you up to the Kurdish area, where the Kurds were thanking the United States for making them free. And it showed you aspects of daily life and the way things looked in a way that I'd never seen before. It's very beautifully shot by this guy, James Longley, well edited, and it actually was giving you a picture of things that you'd never before seen. And that's the things that documentaries at Sundance often do.
Well, the winners were announced over the weekend, and from what I hear, John, you didn't see any of the main winners at the film festival. So does that mean that we're talking to the wrong guy? Does this mean our relationship is over?
It does. Well, it's part of the shame of the thing that you haven't seen them. Yet you need to, you know, people need to understand how this actually works, is that everyone is always picking and choosing from this huge menu of films. You know, five films are showing at once. So in the case of the dramatic competition winner, which is a film called Quinceañera, which I missed that film because I was off seeing the Iraq in Fragments documentary, which actually did win three awards. And so you're constantly being forced to choose. Some years you're lucky, some years you're not. I was on the jury at Sundance one year, and the dramatic film competition winner was a film called Sunday, which I think I can safely say was the film that had been seen by the fewest people ever of any winner. When we announced the winner, there was a gasp from the crowd because they hadn't seen the film. And afterwards, at the closing party, every journalist I knew came up and rebuked me because they were going to look bad with their editors because they hadn't seen the film that won. In fact, I mean, I was there for about 5.5 days. I saw 28 films, I think.
Well, apparently you didn't see enough.
Man, you don't see enough. And so you then seem as if you're not working. And meanwhile, what you are doing is, because of the structure of the city, is that you are taking buses in the freezing cold everywhere, standing outside for 30 minutes in the cold to get into a film. And then as soon as that's over, standing outside again because there's no place to eat there's no real place to eat in some of these screening areas. Okay, and waiting for another film, and then doing that over and over again. So you're watching films for 10 or 12 or 14 hours, and you can still miss the winners, which in fact, you know, makes for enormous anxiety among journalists, and, you know, lots of bitter laughter.
So, John, the fact that you, someone who really knows Sundance, you've been there for 20 years, you were on the jury one year, I mean, you know your way around the festival. The fact that you missed some of the movies that won the big awards, what does that say about the actual meaning of the awards?
Well, the meaning of the awards at Sundance are a tricky thing. And they're tricky because more than most places, you're dealing with people who are unknowns. So you're not starting, you know, at Cannes, for instance, you will know that there's a film by Jim Jarmusch or Lars von Trier, and you'll know the contenders because of that. When you get to Sundance, many of the films are by people who've never made films before, and a lot of those films will have never have been shown, and no one will have any idea what the talent is like. So you're trying to guess which films sound good, or you're following your instinct, or you're thinking, oh, this plot sounds good, I'll go to see that particular film. So that's how you do it. Then by the time, the only people who probably see every film are a handful of journalists and the members of the jury, and they see all of them. And the juries at Sundance are famous for not always choosing the films that you think would win, or for choosing films that don't prove to be the big movie that comes out of Sundance. Last year, the film that won was called 40 Shades of Blue, which had almost no commercial life in the U.S., but the movie that everybody talked about afterwards was The Squid and the Whale. So you actually don't really know for sure whether the award is the most important, in some cultural sense, movie to come out. And you don't know in advance whether it's going to be important. You don't know who made it. And so it's very hard to know your way around.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We'll talk more about the Sundance Film Festival after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up over the weekend. The success of Sundance has actually led this non-commercial, independent film festival to be this big commercial extravaganza. It's not that the films are commercial, but all the stuff surrounding it sounds like it's become very commercial. So do you think finally that's good or bad for the festival? It certainly gets it more press attention, but and more people showing up for it. But is that kind of commercialism likely to kill the actual spirit of Sundance or compromise it in some way? Can the both of them survive together side by side like that?
Well, I think to talk about whether or not it's good for the films, you have to go back to the old days of Sundance. I've been going to the festival since before it was Sundance. And back then, it was actually pretty dreary. The films were small. There weren't stars. And there was no corporate sponsorship to speak of. And when you went, you seemed as though you were just trapped in this small town watching movies aimed at the Lifetime Channel, if there'd been a Lifetime Channel then. Now, there are stars everywhere, and at some level, that actually has helped the independent film world, and it made independent films so important that every studio has its film division. On the other hand, it's probably overshadowed the actual films at the festival. If you listen to the media coverage or read a lot of the media coverage in the Los Angeles Times, you'll find a lot of space being devoted to the gift bags being given to Paris Hilton or Jennifer Aniston. You will have coverage of the parties. When TV does it, they will go for the images that are exciting and that seem sexy and that sell. And those are very seldom the films. So you have this case where you have this huge gap between the fiesta and the festival. And I think it's not clear yet whether that's going to be bad in the long run for the festival or not.
So I know that you feel the parties were particularly commercial this year, that there's a lot of particularly commercial stuff. Nevertheless, I can't really let you go without asking you about the best party that you attended, if in fact you went to any.
Well, actually, probably the best party I attended was for a small film, which actually won an award called Stephanie Daly. What was nice about it was that it was less star-studded, you know, unless you consider Timothy Hutton a star, which I guess he no longer is. But he was there at the party. But it was a very nice, pleasant thing where I was talking to people, and even it grew kind of crazy. One of the things about these parties is that there's always a crush of people at the door waiting to get in. And you're kind of squeezed in as though it were some sort of feed tube. And as you go into the party, somebody else is blocked out. As soon as you leave, they push two more people in. So it's a very mad situation in that kind of way. You know, but I had a good time. Actually, the best times I had were seeing the good films and then talking to people about them. You know, I had some very nice conversations on the shuttle buses between things with people who either wanted to make it in the movie business or who just loved movies so much they came in from Park City for their annual vacation. You know, it's a kind of lovely thing to be someplace where people would actually fly in just to see the movies. And although there are thousands of people who don't, it's always wonderful when you meet people who love movies that much.
Well, John, thanks for talking with us about Sundance.
Okay, sure thing.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and film critic for Vogue. The playwright Wendy Wasserstein died today of lymphoma. She was 55. She was known for her witty plays about women dealing with work, motherhood, feminism, and getting older. She won a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony for her play The Heidi Chronicles in 1989. Here's a moment from our 1987 interview.
I think a theme that runs through several of your plays is women trying to figure out what kind of lives they want to live, uh-huh. What kind of adults they want to be. Was that difficult for you to figure out when you got out of college? Did you flounder around for a while trying to figure out what you wanted to do with your life?
It still is. I don't think it's over. I wish I could tell you yes, and I figured it out, and I'm marvelously happy. I mean, I think that it's something that goes on for a long time. My elder sister is 50 and is quite an interesting woman, and she's still, you know, grappling with these things. My mother still is. I think that there are a lot of choices and there are a lot of definitions, and especially with women, we're given a different definition every 4 years. So 4 years ago, we were told to have it all, and now we're told to be, I think we're beginning to be told to become wonderful mothers again. I get that sense. So I think, yes, I'm someone who's still grappling with that.
Wendy Wasserstein recorded in 1987. 12 years later, at the age of 48, she gave birth to her daughter Lucy. Wasserstein died today of lymphoma. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Marry After All, a debut novel about one woman's struggle to find herself in Newark, New Jersey, by Bill Gordon. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering bachelor's, MBA, master's, and doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been a month since the rollout of the new Medicare prescription drug program. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jonathan Oberlander, author of The Political Life of Medicare, and Christine Castle, author of Medicare Matters. She's a specialist in geriatric medicine and president of the American Board of Internal Medicine. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.